case, Mr. Martin and Mr. Campbell. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, Your Honors. I'm James, AKA Jim Martin, from Martin and Martin Law Firm in Danville, arguing the Ronnie Stone case. I was briefly one of the trial counsels. I was not the one that actually ended up doing the case, but I'm also appointed for it on appeal. There's only one issue here, which is the sentencing with respect to 12 of the 20 years of mandatory minimum time. Pennsylvania County Circuit Court is the court that this comes out of. The Danville, Pennsylvania area doesn't have textiles anymore or much tobacco, but the incarceration industry is booming, and here it was measured in decades, two decades, because Her Honor, thought that she had to under these mandatory minimums. We concede that she did have to impose a mandatory minimum, but only to the extent of 8 years. These were guilty pleas to various drug offenses on various dates, and the Commonwealth chose to mention a gun in only one of those, the ones that have to do with October 30th.
Counsel, if I might interrupt you just briefly in reference to a fact that you're indicating. If I understand correctly from the record, there was a proffer that the gun was found at the time the search warrant was executed. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor, because I was the last.
Wasn't there also a statement from the wife co-defendant that the weapon had been secured by the appellant 2 months before because of concerns about his safety because they had been robbed?
I don't recall that. The summaries are in the appendix at 259. Well, the second one is 259. The first one begins on 256. The one that mentions the gun is...
I'm talking about appendix page
238.
Isn't that about where the wife, during the Commonwealth Attorney's proffer, it comes during his proffer, and that's what's before the court. I just want to make sure that factually we're all on the same page.
Listed in the official proffer, Mr. Hanskins is saying, if necessary, we can produce a witness, that when they raided the house on October 30th, which is the one that we concede the mandatory minimums for, that the gun was found. I think that is correct.
But doesn't it also go on in terms of the proffer that the wife had indicated that they had had the weapon for 2 months prior because of the appellant being previously robbed?
The wife of the I see that now, Your Honor. I did not see that previously.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure, factually speaking, everybody was on the same page before you went into your actual argument.
I think that is what it says, and again, I was not the trial counsel at this point. I've been replaced by that point. So that is certainly in there. But officially, the stipulations only mentioned the gun on October 30th. As I say, these were guilty pleas. We submit the standard of review is that there was an error of law and that it has to be de novo. Other than what Your Honor has said, there's no evidence that that this gun was available on any other date.
If I understand, though, your argument, you speak about use. The actual waiver provision also talks about possession.
That's correct, and the learned counsel for the Commonwealth did point that out about use in his appellee's brief. I'm not saying that it actually has to be used. It has to be available for use, and we would would just submit that the General Assembly chose to make these sentencing provisions somewhat complicated. The court has no authority, the trial court has no authority to exceed them, and doesn't tell you what the burden of proof is. So despite the finding of Your Honor with regard to the wife's statement, which I say I was not aware of, I think this has to be construed in the favor of the accused, and the trial court would be required to do that. The only other things I can see that are comparable to this in any way, you know, just in case the court, even if we don't win this case, wants to like clarify this subsection somehow, are the accommodation provisions and the improper driving provisions.
The statute is unusual in the context of criminal statutes in the Commonwealth, and that is actually a mitigating statute, as I read it. In other
words,
you can actually save yourself some exposure if certain things are applicable.
And well, that's correct, Judge Alston. That's why I hadn't thought of that terminology, but I think that's what I was trying to say with accommodation and the improper driving. I don't know of any other mitigating statutes. In the code, once you get to a certain place and once the Commonwealth gets to a certain place, then if something else happens, we back up and, you know, maybe the drug offense becomes a misdemeanor under...
Some might argue 18.2-251 is a mitigating statute.
Well, because of the sentencing provisions. Yeah. At the sentencing stage, mm-hmm. It is. If you fit into these factors, which I would submit on behalf of Mr. Stone that we do, then... What they just told you was the mandatory minimum becomes no longer the mandatory minimum. Now, of course, the judge could still impose 20 years or even more, but if she didn't have to, we would submit that that is a jurisdictional error because the court doesn't have.
But when we have these statutes that, and I think you're correct in saying that this statute hasn't been analyzed or interpreted very much by the Supreme Court or even this court, you try to figure out what the policy or what you're trying to accomplish in the context of the statute. And my reading of the statute, and obviously correct me if I'm wrong, is that we're going to give an individual a break if there is no gun involved. I'm being simplistic here. There's no gun involved, we're going to give an individual a break. However, if there is a gun involved in any way, either by possession or using connection with the offense, you don't get the break. Where am I misreading 18.2-248CB?
Well, I mean, I think it has to be related to the particular offense. And, you know, the Commonwealth could have, like, had one factual summary. They had two factual summaries. I understand what has been brought out as far as the wife's statement, but I would just submit that, again, it doesn't tell you who has to prove this, but I think it has to be construed against the Commonwealth. If a gun was only either used or available to be used on other offenses on other dates, we just don't know whether it was on this date.
I think it's more in the nature of an affirmative defense, though. It's an affirmative defense in the context of sentencing. In other words, if I'm able to prove this, sort of like your example with accommodation, if I'm able to prove this, that I did not have a gun in my possession, then I'm getting the benefit of this from a sentencing standpoint, which, as you know, we sort of gauge and analyze sentencing prerogatives a little different than we gauge guilt beyond reasonable doubt in the context of culpability on the crime itself.
Well, one might think it was that, Your Honor, but the accommodation statutes have the phrase, if such person proves. Mm-hmm. So that's clearly an affirmative defense, and it even tells you, I think, the preponderance in there somewhere.
But the statute says express language statute requires only a finding that the defendant did not possess in order to avoid the mandatory minimum terms of imprisonment. So you would suggest that it's the government's burden to prove that to prove a negative?
Well, it says if the court finds that. It doesn't really say whose burden it is, but I would submit, yes, that they do have, apparently they have a burden because it's worded differently than the accommodation. I mean, in the reckless driving, it somehow becomes, you know, if you're on trial and the culpability is slight, it somehow goes down to improper driving.
That's more of a lesser included offense as opposed to which maybe a better analogy about the accommodation, which is essentially
that
sentencing
is
issue,
better
which I think is Judge Alston's point.
But, you know, and how were they supposed to do it? I mean, it mentions the factors, you know, in there, you know, the one that has the gun in it did not use violence or credible threats of violence or possess a firearm or other dangerous weapon in connection with the offense. I would submit applies to that offense on that date.
Assuming that this is the Commonwealth, assuming for the sake of argument that this is indeed the Commonwealth's burden, right? What standard of proof would the Commonwealth need to reach to support its position?
Well, you know, they have to prove things beyond a reasonable doubt.
And that's the underlying crime itself.
As far as the crime.
Yeah.
It doesn't say, but I would think it would at least be clear and convincing evidence. I mean, the court would have to think what the standard is because the General Assembly doesn't tell the court what it is. I mean, surely it's, they go into all this convoluted stuff. It surely would be more than the process, I would think. It's like revocation hearings. They have a civil burden of proof, but we don't know what it is. I mean, there's all this stuff about a gun lurking about it. The only thing I can compare it to is when I was a prosecutor, I had all these drunk driving cases where the defendant was like in the car, around the car, above the car. I couldn't put him in the car with the key turned, or I couldn't, say that he drove on a highway, but there he is with the car in the middle of a road or an overpass or a roundabout. And how did he get there? Parachute from a Zeppelin? But I was consistently told by the trial court judges, you know, well, we can't prove that he was driving or operating the vehicle.
But counsel, in this particular case, if I understand the record, the drugs were being dealt out of the house. I don't think that there's any argument or quibble with that. And as far as I understand the record, it indicates that the gun was in the house 2 months prior to the October 30th search warrant. And so if all of the offense dates that everybody can agree are all in October, and the gun was apparently in the house by the co-defendant wife's testimony because of the prior robbery, why couldn't the court determine from that the gun was in fact possessed at the time of the distributions, the prior distributions?
Well, again, it's like the defendant hovering about the vehicle, I think. I mean, the gun is sort of hovering about within a two-month period, but we don't know that it was there the whole time. It's like we don't know if the key, you know, wasn't in the ignition. And, you know, common sense might tell you that he must have been driving there. He's off in the middle of the woods or something. He must have been on a highway because that's the only way to get where he was. But legally, I would just submit that would be insufficient proof that the trial court abused any discretion it might have had on the facts, committed an error of law, and we would ask for a remand to reconsider the sentence as being an 8-year mandatory minimum rather than a 20-year mandatory minimum. I'll be glad to answer any other questions that your honors may have.
Thank you, Mr. Martin.
Thank you.
Alston's point about the purpose of this statute in 18.2-248 in the provision in Part C is to, as Judge Alston pointed, to give the defendant a break if they meet certain enumerated criteria. Essentially, we want to reward less culpable, nonviolent, cooperating defendants. And give them an opportunity to have less time as opposed to other defendants who...
you would submit that this is a sentencing prerogative as opposed to a proof beyond a reasonable doubt prerogative.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And it's something that I've thought about. I will submit to you that we don't really have a lot of case law on this section. There's the Sandbridge case.
Sandbridge arguably is in reference to a different part of this.
It is to a different part. In that case, I read that case, and it doesn't seem like there is any indication of who has the burden of proof with regards to demonstrating all of these criteria. I will submit that what Sanders did do was reference the federal code, which has an identical provision in the federal code. And there's a case I cited on brief from the Sixth Circuit called Volca. And in that case, the Sixth Circuit said that the defendant actually had the burden of proof. And the standard of review that the federal courts look at is a preponderance of the evidence standard. And I would suggest that is probably a correct way of interpreting the Virginia provisions as well.
But their safety valve cases are slightly different, because that's essentially how the federal court determines or what they call this provision that's essentially like a mitigation. That in part is based on congressional intent in terms of how all of that was determined. How are we to make that part of the safety valve from the federal statute, would you argue, analogous here? We don't have any General Assembly intent in terms of how they wanted us to move forward with this particular part of the statute.
I'm not sure I quite understand Your Honor's question.
Let me try to do it again, because it wasn't very artfully phrased. The federal statute that Sandbridge sort of relies on is that safety valve statute. But the underpinnings of the safety valve statute are, when the federal courts are interpreting, they're interpreting congressional intent in terms of what they intended to do. We're making a little bit of a leap that this is in fact a mitigation statute. Because we don't have General Assembly intent. So I'm simply asking, how much can we then rely on the safety valve cases from the federal line?
Well, I mean, I think we could rely on the fact that we use identical language in our code, and we can draw an analogy. Obviously, we do not have the congressional intent like we would in the federal case. But I think it is telling that the provisions are pretty much identical. The element that we are at issue in this case is Part B, and is the question on whether the defendant possessed a firearm in connection with all of the offenses. And it is our position that the evidence was sufficient that this defendant did possess a firearm in connection with all the offenses. As the court has already pointed out, there was a proffer that the defendant had purchased a AK-47 2 months prior to the drug dealing in this case, and that he had purchased that AK-47 for protection. And that sort of begs the question, protection of what? And it's our position that it's protection of a drug dealing house, that all of these transactions occurred in the home of the defendant, where when they actually did the search warrant and they found this loaded AK-47 propped up in the bedroom with ammunition on the nightstand and crack cocaine and $12,000 in cash in the bedroom.
Mr. Campbell, I think the appellant's position, though, is that for the other remaining distributions, there's nothing to concretely put the weapon in the house.
Well, I think it could be a reasonable inference that if they purchase this firearm for protection, there is a reasonable inference for the trial court to make that just mere days after they had made these controlled buys, that they found the firearm in the house, that during this entire month of October that this loaded AK-47 was in the house for the protection of this drug in the house. Obviously, we don't have testimony that they saw the firearm on each occasion, but it is a reasonable inference for a trial court to make that the firearm was have interpreted their quote-unquote safety valve provision broadly, and in the phrase in connection, they have looked at that and said that the phrase in connection means that the firearm facilitates or aids or has the potential to facilitate or aid in the offenses. And it is our position that this firearm certainly has the potential to aid in the protection of this drug dealing that was occurring in this home. I'd also point out that this was the type of firearm in this case is an AK-47 assault rifle. This is not a hunting rifle that is located in a locked cabinet somewhere in the home. If it was, maybe we would have a different.
Well, that's in reference. You're referring to a federal case that talked about the distinguishing factor about the hunting rifle versus something in terms of an automatic rifle. If you're referring to a federal line of cases, does that take away the argument that the plain reading of the statute is not something we should consider?
Well, certainly I think you should look at the plain reading of the statute. And under a plain reading, it's something that's in connection with. I think the court can look at that language and say, is this firearm, we determined that this firearm was in the home during the time of this drug dealing, was that in connection with the drug offenses? Under the plain reading of that statute, you would argue that that satisfies whoever's burden that it is in this case, the Commonwealth's burden to prove that he did not have a gun, or the defendant did not prove by preponderance of the evidence that he possessed a gun.
If you had to assess burden of proof in this case, as far as whether or not it was indeed a weapon that was possessed, where would you think the burden of proof would lie, with the Commonwealth or with the defendant? And I think your opponent colleague makes a good point when he says that in similar statutes, and the most analogous one I think we all agree is the accommodation statute, it specifically says that the defendant shall, as opposed to this one, sort of throws the concept out there and doesn't really tell us who's responsible for it.
Yeah, and that's what I've wrestled with it. And I submit that is a fair point. If it is the Commonwealth's burden, then we would say that it's not beyond a reasonable doubt, and it would be preponderance of evidence that the Commonwealth proved that this defendant possessed a gun.
Okay, and let's assume that it's the Commonwealth's burden by preponderance of the evidence, so it's more likely than not, I guess, is the way that we would look at it. How would we come to the conclusion that in the analysis of this particular case, the gun was connected?
Yeah, in this particular case, we would determine that more likely than not, that this defendant possessed a gun in connection with the drug dealing, because the gun, the proffer that the gun had been purchased prior to the drug dealing that occurred in October of 2015.
And then you go back to your possession cases, which talk about dominion and control.
This defendant constructively possessed this gun during the time that these drug transactions that were occurring within the home. We also point out that this was, I will also submit that I don't know if the defendant had met all of these criteria. The record is really silent on that. So I don't know if the court ordered to somehow reverse this case. I'm not sure. I guess we'd have to remand for further findings. What we have on the record is there was some sort of meeting in chambers between counsel, and they put on the record this part about Part B. So I don't know if it's the defendant's burden, then I'm not sure how we determine that the trial court erred, if we don't know if they had met all the requirements. But I'll just throw that out there because the record's kind of silent on what we do with that. The United States Supreme Court, in a case called Smith versus U.S. from 1993, they talk about a firearm being in relation to an offense, and many of the federal courts have interpreted the phrase in connection to United States Supreme Court said that the presence of a firearm cannot be the result of an accident or coincidence. And we would submit that the presence of this firearm, the type of assault rifle that, that is located in the home, is not an accident or coincidence. And that's what I was trying to make my point about this, some sort of incidental firearm, you know, being located in the house. I think it really cuts against it when you have this type of firearm that was found in the house. The proffer that they had bought this firearm because they were trying to protect their home, which, as the record established, they were dealing drugs out of. There were large sums of cash. There was crack cocaine. This defendant should not be given the benefit or a break, given the nature of the facts of this case. And if the court does not have any questions, I would ask that it affirm the judgment below.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Mr. Martin.
Yes, Your Honor, I think I forgot to reserve some time, but I don't have very much to say. I think I had a little bit of time left. As far as the separate nature of these incidents, the appendix at 226, the Commonwealth's attorney refers to them as distinct, separate buys. That's on page 8 of my brief. And he says on 251 or 250 or 51 of the appendix that the firearm is what kicks him out. As far as whether the other factors are met, they're on page 7 of my brief. All of them except the last one, E, have the word not in them. So if the Commonwealth even has a preponderance burden of proof, which I submit that they do at least, then they haven't shown anything there. The E one has to do, the fifth one has to do with whether they provided truthful information. Well, I mean, I don't know the exact answer to that, but he did plead guilty to all the offenses. And I did not see an argument that he had not cooperated or anything of that nature. So for those reasons, we would just, and the ones that we argued previously, we would just urge the court for a remand. And I think the only question would be the sentence. I don't think there would need to be a redetermination or another opportunity for the Commonwealth to get into the factors, which they decided not to do at the trial.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Martin. We'll come down and greet counsel.